Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
This is Heritage Radio Network.com, and we are burning down the house. Hit it. No, we're not changing the name from Burning Down the House to Layla. I played that for a very important reason. Oh, by the way, that was a Fairway ad, because we're brought to you this Wednesday, 22nd of September 2010, by Fairway Market. Thank you. I am Curtis B. Wayne. Joining me in the studio, we have the ever-popular Caroline Bailey as Vox Populi, the voice of the people.
Hello.
Yes, there you go. Also joining us as an extra special ingredient, Rachel Wharton, the assistant editor or editor?
I'm the deputy.
Deputy editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan, two very influential food publications in the New York metropolitan area. Hello. And Layla, back in the last quarter of the 20th century, when I was in architecture school, there was an unspoken social contract that there would only be one radio in a studio. And you have to picture a room with 15-foot ceilings all painted white and 50 desks, students of different ages, from 18 through 23, working along. But whenever Layla came on the radio, everything stopped. We were just riveted. And we were all having a common acoustic experience that informed our thinking. Now, it's no surprise that designers listen to music, and music is very important. There's stories about old man Wright, Frank Lloyd Wright, alone in the studio, late at night, taking a break from drawing, playing Beethoven on his grand piano. And so what we've lost in the era of the iPod is that common acoustical environment and experience that is informing our feelings and our design thoughts. Because now, if it's a studio with 50 people, there are 50 different soundtracks. And it got me thinking about the sound of a city and music in a city. And indeed, there is a lot of music in New York City. We have Carnegie Hall, Alice Tully Hall, Avery Fisher Hall, the Metropolitan Opera, New York State Theater, Beacon Theater. But, and we have buskers in the subways. But really, I think the most musical city in our country is New Orleans, the Crescent City, the Big Easy. And it's not my interest in getting into a rock music hagiography of Eric Clapton. What we want to talk about this evening is an insider's view on the rebuilding of New Orleans now 5 years after Hurricane Katrina. And so I am happy to say that I, Curtis Wayne, will be joining with my friends here in the studio, speaking with the prolific writer Wayne Curtis, who moved to New Orleans because he loved the vibe there so much. So let's next have some music from the only thing that New Orleans and New York share in common, Louis Armstrong.
St. James Infirmary, saw my baby there. She was stretched out on a long white table, so cold, so sweet, so fair. Let her go, let her go. God bless her. Wherever she may be, she can search this wide world over, but she'll never find a sweet man like me. I'm bragging. When I die, bury me in straight lace shoes and a box back suit, double breasted. Put a $20 gold piece on my watch chain. Yes, so the boys will know that I died standing pat.
Mr. Curtis, this is Mr. Wayne.
Get out. my mirror image.
How you all doing down there?
I'm doing well, but I'm actually still up here.
Oh, no.
I am.
Up here.
In Maine.
In Maine.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that makes you practically bi-coastal.
It is. If you count the Gulf Coast as the third coast, I'm definitely bi-coastal.
Definitely. I have to say I'm very, very pleased that you're able to join us. I have read a lot of your stuff. I've been reading your book about rum. Let me introduce our guest. Wayne Curtis has written extensively for The Atlantic, and he's also written a really interesting book about rum and a bottle of rum, the history of the New World in 10 cocktails, 10 rum, 10 historic rum cocktails.
Right.
And and we'll get to that later, because on heritageradionetwork.com, most of our airtime is devoted to food and drink. Here on Burning Down the House, we're the oddball little cultural thing going on here where we talk about design, architecture, and the creative as opposed to the culinary arts. Now, I really like what you've had to say about the rebuilding of New Orleans. First off, who was asking that? You were asking. Wayne, where do you live in New Orleans?
I live uptown. I live, if anyone's familiar with New Orleans, I'm around the Britannia Theater.
Rachel, do you know that? We have Rachel Wharton, who's a food writer.
My parents are from most of my family's from Lafayette.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, so New Orleans was the first city that I fell in love with.
Yeah, that's not hard to do.
Not at all.
And we also have Caroline, who's... She comes up with really good observations every so often. She's here as vox populi to ask the questions that I'm too dim to realize that need to be asked that are obvious.
Can I hire her when you're done?
Yeah, absolutely. She's available.
I've got time.
Excellent.
And she's from just up the river a little bit and over the mountains.
In Arkansas, though, my grandmother's family is from New Orleans, and they moved over to Arkansas, so I have family down there. French and American.
So we got the house packed here, Wayne, with local experts. I have to say, I've only been in New Orleans 3 times, and I may not be going back for a while because, you know, on Canal Street, and you're trying to get on I-10 to go out to the plantations, and it seems like the obvious way to get there is to hang a left because there's a ramp.
Yeah.
And there's a little tiny sign way up on the... On the overpass, it says no left turn.
Yes.
Yeah, the city of New Orleans wants $200 for me for that, which I declined to send them a check.
Was this before Katrina?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, all records are lost. Records are lost.
Okay.
You got a clean slate. Come on down.
Yeah. Well, it was not very pleasant being pulled over in a rented minivan with my wife, who was there for business, her boss's husband, her kid, and two of my kids being harassed by a hungover, jackbooted NOPD officer.
Were you all hauled off to central lockup?
No. Oh, yeah, that might have been really kind of fun because the police department's really beautiful. It is.
Central lockup. Central lockup's where a lot of visitors to New Orleans get to spend some time. There's mixed responses to it, I think. I'm not sure that anyone refers to it as beautiful, though.
I was meaning the building architecturally.
Architecturally, it's a beautiful building. Inside, not so much.
Is that on Royal Street or something like that?
You're looking at the Supreme Court on Royal Street. That is a beautiful building, although totally inappropriate to the time and place. You got to go further up to Tulane and Broad for Central Lockup, which most people don't get to, and for good reason.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I missed that that gem
of area.
Yeah, I missed that gem of a New Orleans experience.
Yeah.
So, as I understand from looking at your autobiographical notes, you decided to move from Maine to New Orleans because you just loved the vibe so much there. Is it so?
That was a lot of it. I went there shortly after college, and it didn't make much of an impression on me. Maybe it was a blurry impression. I didn't recall much of there. But it didn't go for 20 years, and then I went back down when I was researching my rum book. And it was probably within an hour or two, I was thinking, I should really think about moving down here. And I went back. This was in January of 2005, and then I went back in August of 2005, just a week before Katrina, it turned out. Of course, nobody knew at the time what was going to happen, and by the end of that second trip down there, I started asking myself, why is it that I don't live here? And I couldn't come up with a good answer for that. You know, Katrina put it into question, obviously, but we waited 6 months and went back down, and then a couple weeks after that, I brought my wife down to take a look and realized that not only was the city still alive, but the whole rebuilding process is going to make it more interesting than ever. I mean, just nobody really knew what was going to happen by the middle of 2006. There was still a lot of talk about everyone was expecting another huge hurricane season. Everyone was believing the city was going to empty out. So it was a really interesting time to be relocating down there. And it's worked out well, I think, for the city. Certainly for me, but I think for the city as well. I think the rebuilding process is not as fast as everybody wanted, but it's it's been more interesting and more deep-rooted than people thought it was going to be.
Well, that's good. Among some of the people that I know here in the Northeast, there was quite a lot of cynical talk about, well, maybe we should just write off New Orleans. Maybe rebuilding a city below sea level. Well, not all of New Orleans is below sea level.
Right. That's the first myth that has to be sent away.
Well, yeah, the French Quarter is the original settlement, correct?
Right. That was settled 1718, and that the original settlers were pretty smart. They built at on the highest ground wherever they could. And it turns out the highest ground in New Orleans is along the river, which sort of counterintuitive for a lot of people. Most cities, you know, you set up your storm sewers and everything to flow down to the nearest river, and gravity does all the work. But here it doesn't work that way. It's just the Mississippi over, you know, thousands of years of overflooding its banks sort of created a natural levee, and the heaviest sediment every year during the annual flooding of the river, the heaviest sediment would fall out first, so that would create the most solid ground. And so right along the river is the highest point in the city, and then it slopes down to Lake Pontchartrain.
Mm-hmm.
It was about a 10-foot drop, you know, originally, but thanks to a number of complicated issues involving settling and just sort of reshaping things with bulldozers, it's now a little bit more of a bowl, so that it slopes down and then comes back up to Lake Pontchartrain. So about 50% of the city is at this point below sea level.
Right, and well, we'll get, you know, we'll eventually get around to what you've written up in last November edition of the Atlantic, where you talk about the architectural responses. I mean, there's a lot to love about New Orleans. To me, it's a little bit like Venice. You know, it's the old parts are like historical parks, the Garden District for sure. The French Quarter. Is it true that, you know, all the old shotgun shacks and the indigenous traditional architecture of the poor people, was that all swept away by Katrina?
No. In fact, most of what was damaged by Katrina was later architecture. I mean, post World War II. Much of that was what was affected the most strongly, and that is largely because of hubris. As I said, the early settlers were smart enough to build on the highest ground they could find, so the first settlement was along the river. And not only were they smart enough to build there, they were also smart enough to know how to build houses to deal with regular flooding. So most houses from that era, I say pre-1900, are elevated on brick piers. There's no basements anywhere, basically, in New Orleans, except for some of the downtown skyscrapers. But the older houses are built on like my house is about 100 years old, and it was built within, I guess, about 6-8 blocks of the river, and it's built on brick piers. So the idea being if the river floods, water comes in, water goes out,
right,
you go about your business.
The shotgun shacks are actually built too, right? So the water could just rush in and go right out the other side.
The shotgun?
Well, yeah. They were built to withstand that kind of thing.
Virtually every shotgun's built on piers as well, so it's all designed for that. What happened after World War II, and this is where it sort of gets into some of the politics, is that through hubris, the Army Corps of Engineers came in and basically said, we've solved the flooding. We figured out how to build levees that are impenetrable. We figured out how to pump water out at huge speeds to make sure that any pooling from rainwater doesn't affect, you know, pool up below sea level and start flooding. And it was basically, you know, starting in the 1940s, everyone thought, well, flooding's the thing of the problem, so we can pump out all these cypress swamps that were basically between what was called the back of town, which is behind the French Quarter, to Lake Pontchartrain and start building there. So you end up with a lot of developments that are built not on piers but on slab, just like traditional ranch homes. And they might be 6 or 8 feet below sea level. So that was largely what was decimated. It doesn't mean that there weren't other shotguns that weren't also very badly damaged in some parts of town, but for the most part, the older the building, the better it survived Katrina just because of the location.
Yeah, I actually thought, I mean, I've been to New Orleans many, many times since Katrina and before, that if you went as a tourist, you don't even see the parts that were affected the most. You could go there as a tourist, and it pretty much looks exactly like it did. I mean, you know, because New Orleans is always kind of shabby. It looks much like it did before.
It's true. The French Quarter was basically untouched. There was, I think, one or two buildings that were demolished from the winds and, you know, rain getting under the eaves. And then outside the French Quarter, up in the Garden District, there was some damage, but there's no flooding in the Garden District. So the main parts that tourists would have come down and see in New Orleans pre-Katrina basically have not had a problem. There's other areas that were sort of in between, like mid-city, which did attract tourists. There were cemeteries there. There's Parkway Tavern Bakery for its po' boys. There's the Bayou St. John area. That got quite a bit of water, and there was quite a bit of damage there. But that was sort of a second-tier tourism area where more adventurous tourists would go as opposed to the standard checklist tourists. So if you were a regular tourist with a guidebook, you could have gone down starting sometime around 2008, and not really realize that there had been a major catastrophe there.
But I think the funny thing about New Orleans is that you would be like, oh my God, the city looks terrible, and it's just what it looked like before.
I know, it's true. I've driven people around, and they go, wow, the flooding must have been horrible here, and I say, well, actually, no, there was no flooding here. it's just part of the city. I mean, it's the main dynamic in New Orleans is that it peaked out in its population sometime in the 1950s, you know, right after World War II, and there was a huge boom for all sorts of reasons during World War II there, constructing ships and as a supply port. But it peaked out population around 650,000. Before Katrina, it had dropped over the course of four decades to about 450,000. So you're talking about a major surplus of housing stock. I mean, it was like Detroit in a lot of ways. It's just that the houses were a little more interesting. So there was a lot of blight in New Orleans pre-Katrina. So there was a ton of work that needed to be done to help stabilize the neighborhoods and to sort of concentrate population in areas where people were and where services were anyway. And then Katrina came in and hit a lot of those houses again, that were some of which were pre-blighted and others were post-blighted, you know, blighted from the storm, and people that, for various reasons, couldn't afford to come back and rebuild. So it's always been the long-term trend in New Orleans has been very difficult as far as taking care of blight and reconfiguring the city for a new era. And Katrina, in some ways, worsened it, and in some ways, I think, accelerated the process of helping blighted areas. So.
Oh yeah, great. Hurricane is urban renewal.
Yeah.
I want to take a little musical break here, and then I want to ask you about the people who lived in the bayous and what happened to them. So, Nat, would you rail track three, please?
Drops. we are, burning down the house. That was La Terre Tremblante by Marco Beltrami and Dirk Powell. Nice, doleful Cajun music. Are you still there, Mr. Curtis?
I am still here.
What happened to the people in the bayous? What happened to the Cajuns when Katrina came through?
That's, I'm not an expert on that by any means. I haven't really spent much time over in Cajun country outside Lafayette, either before or after Katrina. From what I understand from a little bit of travel over there, was that Katrina wasn't that devastating. It was Rita that came by a few weeks after Katrina and hit that part of the coast much more forcefully. The way the winds were, the flooding came in, and it wiped out a lot of the houses down in that area. I think the rebuilding's been spotty, depending on where you are. I know I've got a friend whose family had 5 or 6 feet of water in their house down in the bayous.
Oof.
And they came back and they rebuilt, but her parents gathered the family together, and she's got a big family with like 6 brothers and sisters, and told them that we rebuilt now, but if we get flooded again, we're leaving the community, we're moving way inland. So sort of there's a sense of resignation. I mean, all along the coast, New Orleans is defensible. There's ways of protecting New Orleans, if not all of it, a large part of it, but south of New Orleans, when you get between New Orleans and the coast, that's looking much more difficult to defend over the long term. And I think there's a sense of resignation in a lot of the communities that it's something's going to have to change.
Yeah, well, speaking from a northeastern point of view, modified by my Chicago roots, I have to say, I don't have a real understanding of Cajun life anyway. In South Jersey, we have the Pineys, the people who live semi-indigenously and very modestly. But aside from movie lore, I don't think that we really understand much about the culture that they have there. During our break here in the studio, our ladies were talking about the style of life in New Orleans being so different. And I think I want to congratulate you for having, in your one article, having identified that really New Orleans is a Caribbean city because of its Creole roots.
That's not my characterization. That's been repeated a number of people. People said that. In fact, when I moved down to New Orleans, somebody told me that if you try to figure out New Orleans, don't think of it as America's southernmost city. Think of it as the Caribbean's northernmost city, and it'll make more sense to you. That's something that's commonly repeated and often disputed. But in the story, I really was focusing on Andres Duany's feeling, and he believes that very much. And it's not just a matter of lifestyle and architecture and historical roots, historical connections with the Caribbean, but also sort of the approach that people take to building their houses down there. And his main complaint was that all the do-gooders, which he referred to people coming in, including Brad Pitt and others trying to rebuild New Orleans, and mostly he was focusing his antipathy towards FEMA, was that they were imposing Minnesota standards on a Caribbean city and that it just wasn't going to work. They wanted everything, and a lot of this makes a lot of sense, is that they wanted everything elevated above flood levels. They wanted everything ultra-hurricane-proofed. They wanted everything rebuilt extremely solid. And he said, basically, you don't do that in the Caribbean. It's not going to work. Basically, it would make more sense to just allow people to rebuild as they would, and then if it gets destroyed by another hurricane, they rebuild again. It's basically how things are often done in less affluent parts of the world. And his main argument was that the whole lifestyle was built around not the accumulation of wealth, but accumulation of leisure.
Yeah.
One comment was that, you know, New Orleans is the only urban area in the United States where you can live a first-class urban life for very little money, and that by coming in and and even Brad Pitt's projects, which are heavily subsidized, the families, you know, paying for these spectacular high-tech houses, just what they can afford, generally around $60,000. But his point is, even $60,000 in New Orleans is a lot for families in the lower Ninth Ward. And suddenly, they're going to be tied to making these mortgage payments and having to basically move to Minnesota in their minds to be able to handle it all, as opposed to just, you know, providing the money to rebuild as they would. It may not be top standards, but they'd have their lifestyle when they recoup. It's a debatable point, and there's, you know, obvious things like, so you're encouraging people to build houses that will blow down in the next storm. That doesn't sound very safe if you want a debate, but I thought it was an interesting way to look at New Orleans, and I thought he raised some good points.
Hurricane tie downs to secure your roof aren't that expensive. I'm looking at some of the pictures that were in your article of these houses, and they're not raised up that high.
See, it's the lower Ninth Ward houses, or are you looking at some of the other ones?
Well, it's hard to tell where they were, you know. It was hard for me to picture where they were. The flooding after the barge broke through the levee, flooding out those areas, looked like it was 10, 12 feet.
Yeah, that was real catastrophic. I mean, that was a tidal wave when that came through. That was a really, really high wave that came through because of the breach and the failure of the flood wall. If it, under normal circumstances, if the wall had held, it had just overtopped and had flooded, or if water came from another direction and went to sea level, I think you're looking more like 8 or 9 feet. Most of the houses, the Brad Pitt houses in the lower Ninth Ward, are built above historic flood levels. You know, they'll still get damaged if it's another catastrophic breach of the levee wall, but what wouldn't under those circumstances when you have a 12, 15-foot wall of water moving through at 30 miles an hour?
Right.
Yeah. But if it's just flooding from normal channels, which is, you know, say a levee 3 or 4 miles away that fails and the water flows in rather than comes in a tidal wave, the houses are all well engineered for that, including one by Tom Main that floats.
We're not a big fan of Tom Main here on Burning Down the House. Noah's Ark.
Although it's an interesting question. This is the most interesting design question for these elevated houses. If you've been down to the Carolina coast or other, you know, areas that are affected by high waves, a lot of people build their houses up 10, 15 feet.
Oh, and sure.
How do you make a neighborhood out of that? I mean, you don't. There's no, you know, front stoop to sit on. It's just these
houses on wooden piles. Yeah, I've been to Duck and I've been to Corolla, and the houses are all way up in the air.
But those aren't really neighborhoods.
Well, that's the problem with the lower Ninth Ward was a neighborhood. It was
exactly
a really tight neighborhood before, and so the question was, yeah, we want to raise people up out of harm's way and put them up at least 8 feet above the ground, so if there is flooding that they don't have to rebuild their entire house. On the other hand, there's a neighborhood that in pre-Katrina was built around outdoor barbecues, hanging out in the carport, talking with your neighbors. It was an extremely congenial place. So the question is, how do you combine safety with neighborliness? And I think that's what Tom Main was trying to get at, was that, yeah, we can make these houses safe, but still make it look like a neighborhood where people want to live on the ground. It makes sense. There's another house, I believe it's under construction now in the second phase, where the architect, Byron Mouton, who built a two-level house with basically the lower level, and it was sacrificial, so you'd put, you know, you'd have materials down there that could just be pressure washed afterwards, and if a hurricane warning comes in, you move all your valuables and your furniture up to the second floor, evacuate. When you come back, assuming that you did get 3-4 feet of water, you just come in, you can hose down the lower level, and it's got, you know, electric is coming in from the top rather than the bottom, just so things like that, so you don't have to redo everything, and then you go about your business. So that was another approach to trying to prevent houses from being 8 or 10 feet off the ground, but still being safe and sensible in a flood-prone environment.
No, that's a good idea. I've seen that in sensible beach houses in Jersey that or near to the ocean, where the first floor is nothing that can get waterlogged.
Yeah. So that's the lower Ninth Ward, and that's you know, whether you like the style or not is another question. There's a whole secondary thing which I didn't get into in the story here, which is once these architects designed the buildings, they handed them over to Make It Right, and Make It Right built them. The architects no longer had any involvement. And for cost-cutting reasons, they're doing a lot of modifications, and some of them, I think, are real tragedies of design. Take these really interesting swooping forms and just sort of truncating them or cutting them off halfway, or instead of making them out of, you know, aluminum sheeting, they'd make them out of plywood to save costs. And some of them are just horrible looking. And yeah, I know a lot of the architects are getting a little cranky about that, but, you know, it's a balancing act. You want to make them affordable, but...
Well, yeah. Speaking as an architect, part of the design brief is that you should, I put that in quotes, be mindful of the budget.
Yeah. So how did people get those houses? If it was your property and you owned that piece of land, you get that house on your land?
Yes, that was it. Was the folks who owned the lots applied to have houses put there, and they were, and there was sort of, you know, a perimeter set up of several blocks, and that was priority. The idea was, we don't want just to scatter these houses all over the lower Ninth Ward, so we have a concentrated area. The idea being that if we have, you know, 100, 150 houses in this one area, that'll create a, you know, sense of mass and momentum, and hopefully encourage development around the periphery of it, and it would, you know, expand out like a seed. So the people who had the lots were the first priority, and then some people sold their lots to Make It Right, and the city took over others that were abandoned, and, you know, people just stopped paying taxes on it, said, I'm done. And the city has been, and the state have been selling some to Make It Right Foundation to build on, and then they are offering up to people who may not have owned that lot first, but lived in the lower Ninth Ward elsewhere pre-Katrina. So they're really working on making sure that the neighborhood comes back with more than just buildings, but also with some of the previous social connections. Which
is,
I
that
think
actually working?
Oh, it's too early. It's too early to say right now. I think in large part it is. People are happy to see their neighbors coming back, and, you know, once things start moving in, people start moving in, others are more inclined to take a second look at coming back, even if they'd resettled in Houston or someplace. But it's too early to say. I mean, of the 150 houses they have planned, I think there's maybe 35 occupied now, something like that.
Gee, so that's 35 houses out of hundreds and hundreds that used to be there.
That's pitiful.
Yeah.
That is,
I mean, because I can't remember, when was the last time you were in that neighborhood?
Me?
Uh-huh.
3-4 months ago.
So I haven't been in at least a year, maybe even longer than that. And the last time I was there, I mean, it's like Chernobyl. It's like I'm not kidding. It's like acres and acres and acres. It was acres and acres and acres of emptiness.
Yeah, the slabs and steps and overgrown.
Like, yeah,
lawns.
Like aliens had sucked away all the human life. And it's hard for me to imagine 35 houses. And then it's like, that's nothing.
But it's 35 that they have construction. They have at least over 100 in the pipeline. And then there's others that are sort of infill, people that didn't want to get involved with Make It Right.
Uh-huh.
There are other houses that are cropping up. The church groups are coming in and building for people in between some of the Make It Right houses. There's others that are coming up in the immediate area. I mean, it's going to take time. The Lower Ninth Ward is sort of a special case because it was like the, you know, the thumb of God had come down and wiped it all out, just like big smush. And took, you know, whatever that was, a 20 by 40 block area and just left slabs. Where other parts of New Orleans didn't have that sort of catastrophic change. So I don't think you can judge what's happening there. You can't compare it to what's happening elsewhere in the city. It's going to be a very different process there because you're basically starting with open field development. You know, the big concern after the storm, when Brad Pitt announced that he was going to rebuild there, it was a huge outcry in the lower Ninth Ward because everyone thought that they basically were going to, you know, by eminent domain, take all of these lots and then create group housing or condos or something to bring people back in. And when there was some backlash, the Make It Right people had a neighborhood meeting that Brad Pitt showed up at, and they basically said, we don't want, you know, Donald Trump coming in and redeveloping this whole area and setting aside some, you know, low-income housing for us.
Yeah.
So good, good for them. Yeah.
They, he sort of revamped. The original plan was, I think, to acquire lots and then build and then sell. And then after listening to them, they revamped their approach and decided, okay, whoever owns the lots keeps the lots. We're going to build for them. So
super.
There was change along the way.
Good. Let's take a little break here. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of the some of these urban planning issues. Burning down the house. You still there?
Still here.
We have the best lively conversations when we're on musical break here. We're all getting really heated over the fact that there's plenty of money for Haiti, but if it were to go to New Orleans, it would be a handout.
Yes.
And what kind of idiocy is that?
Well, I don't know that there's plenty of money for Haiti. I think Haiti's woefully underfunded for its rebuilding, just as New Orleans has been. But it's all political. I mean, there's a lot of issues between the Bush administration and everything about where the money ended up going and why. So so much more of it ended up going to Mississippi relative to the damage that occurred, just I think largely because Haley Barbour was the governor there during Katrina.
Yeah, well, there you go. Right.
So there's a lot of issues about money, and a lot of it, I mean, there's some good, worthy concerns about Louisiana's history of corruption and
no, really?
No, I swear. you know, just by sending blank checks is not a good thing for most localities.
No, I don't think it should have been blank checks. Like I always just thought, it's like, why couldn't we just, you know, Oprah, someone who has a bajillion dollars, let's just scoop up all of the debris from every single house and then put down another shotgun house, boom, 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 in every single lot that somebody actually owned and still lived. It's like, I don't know. That's ridiculous. That would never happen, but it was so frustrating.
What are you smoking?
Exactly. But it's like, that's the, because it just, there was so much
Rachel's
time.
From, you have to understand, Rachel's from Brooklyn. This is a libertarian democracy here.
But it was the waiting. I mean, it's like these families don't know what they're going to do. They have no choice but to start other lives in other places.
And well, you've got to say that with Haiti, that is more recent, and they have been rebuilding much faster than they have in New Orleans. They're talking about rebuilding their houses, and they're complaining that they don't want concrete roofs, or they don't want...
There's still 3,500 tent camps in Haiti.
I know, but it's so recent. But they're rebuilding much faster per capita than anything in New Orleans.
What I wanted to ask...
Well, I just feel like there was a huge debate for a year, if not longer, what to do with the Ninth Ward in particular. It's like,
sure.
Can no one go back to live there?
Yeah, but
do I own my property still?
No, I want to talk about urban planning opportunities. What about the corner stores? What about commerce? You can't have a vibrant community again in a place that has been a walker's paradise if you can't walk to the store to get a six pack. I mean, you know,
New Orleans is in much better shape than a lot of cities for that. I mean, New Orleans never really went through the most brutal forms of urban renewal back in the 60s and 70s. It was just too poor.
But what I meant was...
There's some exceptions to that.
Yes, okay, so we have all these star architects who have their wackadoodle stuff and they're putting in the really devastated areas. What about...
Yeah, forget those guys.
And I'm not interested in how they look. I'm interested in how they work and how they work in terms of community. And the community needs small business. The people need jobs. They need something they can work to.
Make It Right is not really address that, but I don't fault them for it. There was not a... The Lower Ninth Ward was not a compact, walkable community before the storm. It was more... Had more the layout of a post-war subdivision.
It was a bedroom community.
Yeah, in some ways. But it's also... It used to be a agricultural communities, so still had some ties to the truck farms from the early days. But for the most part, there wasn't a lot of commerce in the Lower Ninth Ward. You went up to two of the big boulevards up there. St. Claude or Claiborne were the stores were, and that's been a problem. You know, those are not coming back like they should. It's a catch 22. The stores aren't going to come back because the population's not there, and then the population's a little less interested in coming back because they got to go across the bridge to do their basic shopping.
Uh-huh.
Could those stores even stay in business, though?
Right now, probably not.
Yeah.
I think they were having trouble before Katrina, too. But there's been some innovative things trying to address that. A lot of the people in the Lower Ninth Ward don't drive. They never did, because they couldn't afford cars or didn't have licenses. And they've rejiggered the transit system. They have the call on demand now that basically connects to a supermarket, so you can just call in advance, go up to within a two-block area, there's a pickup point, and they'll take you to the supermarket and then pick you up when you're done and take you back. So they're trying some innovative things like that. It's certainly not a replacement for having being able to pick up beer and bread within a three-block walk of your house, but They're trying it. I mean, as I said, the Lower Ninth Ward was never a paragon of a walkable community with lots of mixed commercial and residential pre-Katrina. So we have to expect for that to bounce back in a wholly different form. is, and the people who live there weren't clamoring for that. They wanted it, what was there before, which was a residential area.
Well, with all this land, what about truck farms? You know, that I don't know if you're aware, but here in Brooklyn, it's an enormous urban farming movement that's happening.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. It's happening in a lot of communities. It's happening in New Orleans slowly. There have been some lots in the Lower Ninth Ward have gone back to being truck farms. There's a very ambitious project in New Orleans East, which is the lowest lying area. You know, it's about 12 feet below sea level, and it's predominantly Vietnamese. And they've got a large scale project underway to put in farming there and a farmers market, community farmers market there. Some of these projects are perking along, and there's a push for it. I mean, the number of farmers markets that have cropped up since Katrina has been pretty impressive. It's happening, but there's also some difficult political issues, because a lot of people, many people, I think, oh great, this is below sea level, let's just go in and put a 5-acre garden in and grow produce for the city. I mean, these is where people were born and raised and grew up, and they're not so keen on that idea. It looks, smells to them like a land grab. So a lot of these issues still have to be worked out, and it's not so easy just to say, which is what the Ford Foundation study said immediately after Katrina. Within a few months, their study said, "Let's take these low-lying areas and convert them to a more practical use." Makes a lot of sense. Politically untenable.
Ah, interesting. Especially for us here at Heritage Radio Network, because our station is in two shipping containers, and there's a greenhouse on our roof.
Nice.
And the vacant lot next door has been taken over by our host restaurant, Roberta's, and turned into an urban farm with raised beds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing thing.
I think that's what I was talking about earlier, was just the waiting on a decision. I mean, Because someone wasn't like, we're going to turn the entire Ninth Ward, I know this is really painful to you because your family's lived there for five generations, that the first time you've ever owned any property in your lifetime, into an awesome truck garden. It's like, if that decision had at least been made, politically incorrect as it was, I mean, it's just this stagnation of decision making.
I'm going to disagree with you.
You think so?
I think everyone wanted it rebuilt in a year, and it was never going to happen. I always.
But who, everyone,
it was gonna be a
everyone who lived in New Orleans.
10 to 15-year process to rebuild New Orleans. We're 5 years into it now. What's happened is that the centralized planning approach collapsed, and it's now become a neighborhood series of growth. So I think what's going to emerge from New Orleans is going to be a lot more interesting. You know, the initial thought was, and this is what central planning leads to, is, okay, we've lost 60,000 houses. We need builders down there that can build houses quickly, cheaply, efficiently, and economically. What we need is KT Homes, and we need Toll Brothers to come in and build acres and acres of houses. So basically what the original proposals were, and the people were seriously looking at this until the home builders look at this and realize, no, this isn't going to happen, was basically create huge Levitt towns all through the flooded areas of New Orleans, just basically cookie-cutter houses that you could manufacture outside the city.
That's
truck
what I was
in
talking about.
A setup, put it all in, and what would you have ended up with? Nothing that anyone would be all that happy with. I mean, the idea it was,
well,
just
you could
was
build
resistant.
Those kinds of houses that it sounds terrible, but you could build cookie cutter houses. I mean, those houses were kind of cookie cutter. You could build cookie cutter houses that weren't awful.
Yeah, but Rachel, the model of a cheap house,
yes,
on a slab on the ground, which is the cheapest kind of house that you can do, was not sustainable. They got whacked.
Yes, but in like a 100-year storm kind of thing.
The within months of Katrina, the Katrina Cottage, Marianne Cusato's house was designed, and it's a beautiful house. What is it, 450 square feet or something? It was designed to be, it's a shotgun style house, although with a little more privacy, basically one bedroom. And this was, I thought, one of the great plans that anyone had. It was cheaper than a FEMA trailer. Those ended up costing $60,000 or $80,000 to deliver and remove, and then they were toxic. The Katrina Cottage. The idea was put it on the lot. And the interesting thing about New Orleans lots is they're fairly uniform, generally 30 feet wide by 120 feet deep throughout the city. You could put a Katrina cottage on the back. You could live in that while you rebuild the rest of the house. When you're done, what do you have? You've got a guest house or in the back or whatever you want to use it for, a storage shed. It's something that just stays there. However, under federal law, you can't do that because federal law would be competing with private home builders by giving away these permanent houses. Under federal law, in an emergency, FEMA can only provide emergency housing, which means crappy trailers that have formaldehyde and make you sick. That's what's allowed. So there were some great ideas, but every great idea runs aground on all sorts of financing. It would have been cheaper than doing the FEMA trailers, but it was on federal law. And that, you know, comes down to private home builders having some time ago lobbied the federal government to make sure that in the event of an emergency, they get their first in line and they're not competing with the federal government to have housing. So they could not put in housing that would be permanent. I mean, for $60,000 or $80,000 for these FEMA trailers, you could have restored the great majority of the flooded houses on just that money alone. I mean, there was all sorts of missed opportunities.
Well, I guess that's what I meant by financing, not that there wasn't money, but that the money had to go to this particular thing.
It's all appropriations law.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's complicated.
So, as an observer, I guess you keep an arm's length away from opining in a political way, huh?
I try to.
Yeah. Okay. We have just a couple minutes left, and I think we just wanted to ask you a little bit about your rum research, because it is Heritage Radio Network. Of the 10 cocktails, which is your favorite?
I'd have to go with the depending on the time of year. I'll stop equivocating. The daiquiri. I think the daiquiri is a great drink. It's just it's simple. It's refreshing. You can vary it quite widely, just depending on the proportions you use. It's almost the perfect drink, you know.
I was rather trending towards the rum shrub.
Yeah.
With the a little vinegary and a fruit syrup that gets mixed in with the rum.
Yeah, those have been coming back the last year or two, seeing a lot more about shrubs. Shrubs were just basically a way, pre-refrigeration, to capture the flavor of summer. So if you had raspberries or if you had strawberries, you'd make a shrub out of them, which was basically, I guess, sort of like a liquid jam. I guess you used the acid and the vinegar to preserve it, and then you could put it up in jars. And then, you know, in February, when things are really bleak, you can take a little shrub and pour it in and mix it up with rum and have a nice little drink. It tastes very summery.
Now, doesn't that sound like a perfect Roberta's cocktail?
Yes.
The people here are totally into...
Put that in the margarita machine back in the tiki bar.
Yeah, absolutely.
How much time do you have?
Roberta's has the margarita machine?
Yes.
Yeah, we have it.
It's brand new.
Yeah, there's a tiki bar here.
One thing I wanted to ask this whole time was you glossed over how, like, a couple of weeks after Katrina, you were like, I took my wife to see New Orleans and we agreed to move down there, which seems totally amazing that you would both be on the same page.
It is a little bit amazing. But we've been living in Maine for close to 20 years, and she was tired of the Maine winters, and I was tired of listening to her complain about the Maine winters. So she was pretty open to a southern move, mm-hmm. and the timing was just right. And she loves New Orleans too. I mean, she really loves it. She's working at she's a public defender, so she's busy all the time. Crime doesn't take a break down there, and still loves the city. So
wow, I'm afraid we've run out of our legal limit of time here. Gosh, it went so quickly.
It did. I enjoyed it.
If you get anywhere near New York, please come and see us in Brooklyn. I think you'd really find it interesting. Actually, we were written up in the style section of the New York Times. You can read about it online, about this collective environment of people involved in this station. Roberta's Restaurant, which has a wood-fired pizza oven, their garden, their urban farm, and it's all of a piece here of trying to grow the movement of spreading better thinking about how do we live, right?
Yes, we muddle through it.
Well, good luck with it.
Well, thank you. So we'll be in touch. I really appreciate your time. This has been Burning Down the House, brought to you by Fairway Market. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Been speaking with Wayne Curtis, the writer, who lives in New Orleans, but was brought to us by the miracle of telecommunications from Maine. Also with Rachel Warden.
Hello.
Caroline Bailey. Thanks for listening. Talk with you again soon.